listening to the Survival in Motion podcast. Learn, adapt, prepare, survive.
Hello, everyone. This is author Cal Wilson. Welcome to another episode of the Survival in Motion podcast. On today's episode, what I'm going to do is discuss Dave Ramsey, his financial advice, and specifically his seminar, which is entitled Financial Peace University. I would recommend you take it, but I have a few reservations and a few comments I wanted to make. First, I think this is appropriate to discuss on a prepper podcast. I think that having money and minimizing the debt that you have, or having no debt at all, also having a money cushion and a good retirement income, these are all legitimate survival issues. We're not talking about the end of the world as we know it, but still, I think it's legitimate to talk about something like this on a prepper podcast. As I've talked about before, survival in motion means the small stuff on up to the end of the world and everything in between. So this is one example of in between, just how to handle your finances, how to minimize your debt, how to save up for retirement, that kind of thing. So I think it's appropriate to talk about this on a survival podcast. The Financial Peace University is taught by Dave Ramsey, and it's also taught by his daughter, Rachel Cruz, C-R-U-Z-E, and also his former employee named Chris Hogan. It's mostly taught by Dave Ramsey, Financial Peace University is. Now, Dave Ramsey fesses up, and this is one thing I like. It's kind of like a pastor in a church who gets up and talks about sin and heaven and hell, and you figure, well, this guy's not going to fess up to having done anything wrong. Well, I set up and take notice when I'm in church and there's a pastor who says, this is sin, that's sin over there. But take it from me because I screwed up in the past, that kind of thing. I'll sit up and take notice when a pastor says that and I'll realize, hey, this is somebody just like me. I know I've sinned. I've screwed up in the past too. Well, anyway, Dave Ramsey has an interesting life story. He got out of college and immediately went into real estate and was pretty quickly building up a really nice real estate empire. And then at some point, through banks being sold off to each other and somebody new on his account decided to call all of his loans, he went bankrupt. And he admits that early on, he played it fast and loose and didn't watch out for his debt and that kind of thing. He describes in detail about the mistakes he's made and how the fact that he was broke and he and his family were wondering how they were going to feed themselves, that kind of thing. So I like that. When somebody says, okay, I'm here to give you some financial advice and you can take it from me because I screwed up long ago and this is what I learned from that. I pay attention to somebody when they put it that way. Anyway, Dave Ramsey nowadays, he writes books. He has a radio talk show that he hosts. He has YouTube videos. And also, I wanted to say, while we're on the subject, that Rachel Cruz, his daughter, has a website, and she's written books as well, rachelcruz.com. And Chris Hogan has also written books and is also a motivational speaker. Okay, so what is Financial Peace University? And let me direct you to the website, Dave Ramsey. ramsey.com. You can find out a lot of details about Financial Peace University. It's a seminar that is taught at churches, well, mostly churches, but I've seen it offered at realtor offices. I've seen it offered at schools. I've seen it offered even at a coffee shop. And it's basically 9 lessons for $120. And no, you can't charge it. The lessons are one day a week, whether it's a night or at church, it's one day a week before the sermon or whatever. And each lesson is 1 hour of video lecture and testimonies, which are very good. I think the testimonies are invaluable. Then after the 1 hour video lecture and testimonies, there's 1 hour of workbook exercises in the class and also class discussion. So that's why I call it a 9-week seminar. Let me say this. I think it's rare nowadays when we have this opportunity of listening to somebody give us wisdom, especially on financial stuff. And if you think about it, the few times all of us have been given financial wisdom, it's mostly by somebody who's trying to sell us something. And I'm blessed in the sense that I had a grandmother who was great in instilling in me financial wisdom. And I define wisdom loosely as knowledge plus experience. And so it's rare nowadays when we can get a parent or a grandparent who has nothing to gain, just to pull us aside and say, I think what you're doing in that financial part of your life is wrong. The way you can improve it is doing this. Or the way to buy a house is do this. The way to prepare for this big financial expenditure you have coming up is to do this. And especially if we can have the parent or the grandparent say, yeah, I made some mistakes when I was in your shoes, and this is how I screwed up, and this is how I'd recommend that you do it next time around. You know, this is how I learned from it. This is how I did better second time around. And this is how I think you should handle it. I think receiving wisdom along those lines is pretty rare nowadays. Now, Dave Ramsey does make money from giving his financial advice. Like I said, he has a radio talk show. He has YouTube videos. He has books. And he even gives endorsements to like realtors and financial planners. So he does make money off of his financial advice in different ways. But here's the key. Here's the key. I've taken this seminar twice now, and I don't believe, I could be wrong, I don't believe that the money he makes distorts his financial advice. In other words, I think if he was not making these endorsements or book sales or whatever, I think his advice would be the same. So I would listen to this guy. I think he has some good financial advice to give out there. Not only, you know, his radio and YouTube channel and books, but also in this Financial Peace University. He's keen on saying, follow everything 100%. And that's what I disagree with. I'll be talking about this later. But let me start off with this. A number he begins with, and his daughter, Rachel Cruz, has also mentioned it. 78% of people in the United States live paycheck to paycheck. That means that when they get paid, their money immediately goes out to bills, some of which are past due. And a lot of times their credit cards are maxed out. And if there's even the slightest upsetting of the apple cart, even if the slightest financial emergency happens, they go into debt, they overspend, they might go bankrupt. 78% of the country is like that. And that's why I think most Americans need this financial advice. Another thing that I like about Dave Ramsey's advice and the Financial Peace University advice is that it focuses on behavioral aspects and psychological aspects. And those are the aspects that will put you into debt, that will give you bad financial habits. And those are taken into account in his advice. And I think it's important and it works. All right. Here are the Financial Peace University lessons, all nine of them here. Lesson one, build a starter emergency fund and learn how to budget. And specifically, they talk about $1,000 cash. Save $1,000 cash, put it in a safe in your house. And that's, again, that's kind of a behavioral, psychological thing that you can, after a while, after a month or two or three, whatever, you can save up $1,000 in cash and just sock it away, whether it's a safe or safety deposit box or under your mattress or whatever. And that's an accomplishment that you've made. That's your first step on becoming financially legit, on getting out of debt and getting your finances under control. That's step one, the $1,000 cash. And of course, the budget. Lesson two, pay off all debt. Specifically, the snowball approach, and I'll talk about that later. Lesson three, save a fully funded emergency fund. And by that, he means 3 to 6 months of expenditures in a money market savings account. Lesson four, invest for the future and build wealth. Lesson five, buyer beware. Lesson six, the role of insurance. And I think there's some very good advice there. Term life insurance is a great advice, I think, and he explains it pretty well. Lesson seven, retirement planning. Lesson eight, real estate and mortgages. Lesson nine, living and giving like no one else. Now, I'm going to start off talking with my disagreements, starting with not 100% following. I think it's okay to deviate on a lot of this advice. I think his advice is very good, but I think it's okay here and there if you deviate from some of the rules. I'm sorry, I know he would not like hearing somebody say that, but I feel strongly about that, that not everything he says is good advice, and I'm about to talk about it. Okay, my first disagreement with Dave Ramsey and the Financial Peace University. I was never convinced that it was applicable to people who were self-employed. All the examples of budgeting and even using their budgeting app that they offer, everything assumes that you're going to get a specific, predictable amount of money every month. And as I was sitting there in that class, there was another self-employed couple nearby, and we were looking at each other, kind of shrugging our shoulders, like, I'm not sure if this really applies to us. The closest I think it can apply to a self-employed person is this. Pull out your tax return for last year and the previous 2 or 3 years, and look at last year. It was line 6 of the 1040. It's that line that basically says, all right, cut the crap. You know, how much income did you make last year? Like I said, 2018 on the 1040 form, that was line 6. I think for most self-employed people, that line from 1 year to the next doesn't fluctuate that much. So what you can do is just picture that number, and you can figure if this year you're making more money or if this year you're making less money than you did the year before, and kind of adjust it that way and then divide it by 12. And that's the closest you can use as a monthly budget figure, and just go with that. And you got to figure for self-employed people, budgeting, there's a whole lot of fudge factor, because you can have a really lousy month if you're working for yourself, or next month might be a fantastic month. As my dad used to say, he worked for himself as well. It's feast or feathers every month when you're working for yourself. And that's the closest I came to figuring out that, okay, that maybe this budgeting advice can work for me, even though I work for myself and I can't really plan that closely what I will bring in every month. There's another disagreement I have here. It's on mortgages and houses. I have taken this class twice, and I've listened to what Dave Ramsey has to say about buying a house. Basically, he says either two things: either save up cash and pay cash for a house and have it paid off, which I don't think is realistic. It kind of reminds me of that conversation in It's a Wonderful Life, you know, when Mr. Potter was saying, hey, these people just need to save up before they buy a house. And George Bailey, who I ran into a few episodes ago, George Bailey said, wait a minute, save up for what? For them to be at death's door and have their kids be gone? You know, is it too much to ask for somebody to have a house mortgage? All right, getting back to what I was saying, I don't think it's realistic to save up to buy a house with cash. I think George Bailey made a good point. I guess that's possible, but I wouldn't be surprised if you pay for a house with cash when you're 90 years old, you know, and it's almost about time for your family to put you in a nursing home if you're not lucky. But I'm okay with taking out a mortgage for a house. He had a second proposal for buying a house, and I honestly could not understand it. It sounded to me kind of like a private party mortgage. Anyway, I never really understood. I think home mortgage is fine. Now, the Schedule A mortgage interest deduction is not today what it used to be. In other words, when you buy a house on a mortgage, your first few years are going to be almost all mortgage interest. And when you accumulate a whole lot of mortgage interest payments, and then you get a statement, you can put that on your Schedule A, and that can deduct your taxes. That's mostly no longer the case. The Schedule A mortgage interest deduction is just not what it used to be. But I still think it's okay to have a mortgage that you're paying off a house that you live in, and you can say, well, I own it. Okay, actually, the bank owns it, but I'm the one in charge of everything here, for better or for worse. You know, I can claim total privacy in my house. No bank can come in and say, yeah, we want to check out. No, no. But I also have to repair everything. That's part of home owning, you know. But I think a home mortgage is fine, even though Dave Ramsey would consider it debt. Here's the thing. If you have a family and you rent an apartment or you rent a house, and just picking figures out of thin air, you spend like $1,500 a month rent. You're not building up equity at all. Now, of course, there's a plus side to that too. The repairs are somebody else's problem. And if you need to, you can get up and move and leave at almost a moment's notice. But I think mortgage is better. Now, if that same rental house, instead of renting it for $1,500 a month, instead of that, if you paid $2,000 a month, I think that's better, because with a mortgage, you're building up equity in that house. And at some point, you know, you can pay off mortgages early. And that's kind of a nest egg. You know, for a lot of people, the equity they own in their home is their biggest amount of money. Okay, I've got another disagreement with Dave Ramsey. The 10% tithe issue. First off, he says 10% of your gross income. And I don't think that's realistic. You can spend a ton of money, you know, if you work for yourself and bring in a ton of money. But if the gross income that you're bringing in just barely pays off your marketing, then you're running in place. You're not really getting ahead. And Dave Ramsey would say, okay, well, that gross income, take 10% of that and give it to your church. Well, I don't agree with that. I think net income is what it's all about. And also, giving it to your church, you know, there are a lot of really good Christian charities out there that do a lot of work all over the world. And you can look them up on charitynavigator.org. And that's a good way of deciding what charities to contribute to. And by apples and apples basis, you can compare the administration costs of these charities. Now, I don't expect to find a charity where they just don't pay anybody anything. I don't think that's realistic. And I have contributed money to Christian charities that have a good, healthy overhead. I'm okay with that, so long as it doesn't get carried away. Anyway, you can compare different charities and their overhead, meaning salaries and stuff like that, at charitynavigator.com. So I'd encourage you to check that out. And not only give to your church, but also give to Christian charities. On the other hand, come to think of it, there is one Christian charity out there. I don't remember the name, but their overhead is zero. But that's only because some rich guy died and set up an endowment, and that will pay the overhead. So when people contribute to that charity, basically, they're not contributing anything to administrative costs. I don't think administrative costs are that bad. So, all right, here's another thing about tithing. Dave Ramsey considered it like only a financial thing. Hand money over to your church. I think there's a lot to be said about volunteering. And I don't talk about it too much, but my family and I volunteer at our local nursing home. But if you're in an active church, there are a lot of people, and like I said, they don't talk about it all the time. It's not something they're doing to impress other people, but it's something that they do, and it's something you can do too, and it feels great. It's a great opportunity to volunteer your time, whether it's a nursing home or wherever. But you can find out where to volunteer just by asking around at your church. You know, we've got people in our church who volunteer at the local homeless shelter. The churches in our neighborhood alternate between which church will send volunteers to a free food place. I can't remember the name they call it, but different Christian churches in the neighborhood volunteer, and they send their volunteers in one weekend, and then they'll alternate. So I think Dave Ramsey talks about tithing 10% of the gross, and it's money only, and it goes only to churches. I disagree with that. Here's something else I disagree with, and that is he talks about saving money by sending money into an IRA or 401k or Roth IRA, in other words, a tax-sheltered account, which is good. But it's all money in the stock market. And he's talking about S&P 500 index funds. And then he runs these calculations, assuming 12% annual return. The figure I've always heard when it comes to S&P 500 index is 8% a year. Whether you're going to get that or not, I don't know. But if you look back in the last 60, 70 years at the S&P 500 index, it's usually right around 8% a year on average. So, I disagree with his 12% figure. I think 8% is more like it. Here's what I do like about this discussion about savings, though. If it's in a tax-sheltered account, you don't have to pay taxes next year on the income you're making this year. And that adds up. It compounds, you know, from one year to the next, to the next, to the next. When you start compounding tax-free, that's a great thing. And his website at daveramsey.com even has kind of a worksheet that you can enter. How much retirement money do you have now? How much do you think you'll contribute to your retirement account every year? And what kind of return do you think you're going to get every year? Well, the return part is easy. I just put in 8%. And just for starters, I put in zero retirement saved. And I put in $2,000 a year added to the savings account. And within only just a few years, after compounding tax-free, it wound up being $1 million. Okay, I thought I would do this, and bear with me. I'm going to do it live on my calculator right here. $2,000. Let's say you have nothing, and you're, say, 19 years old. July 1st, you add $2,000 to an IRA. Okay, right after you deposit that, you have $2,000, obviously. Then a year from then, you have, figuring 8% gain, $2,160, and then you add another $2,000. Okay, then you have $4,160. 1 year later, figuring 8% gain, you have $4,492, and then you add another $2,000. Okay, then you have $6,492. 1 year later, let's figure another 8% gain. You have $7,012 and you add $2,000. All right? Then you have $9,000. Now, figure 8% gain on that, $9,733, and you add another $2,000. Now you've got $11,733. Now, notice every year you're making 8% on whatever was there before, but you're not having to pay taxes on it. So let's figure 11,733 times 8% gain. Now you have $12,671, and then you add another $2,000. That's only just a few years, and now you've gotten $14,671 just by adding $2,000 a year. And if you find an S&P 500 index fund, hopefully with low management fees, then that's how much money you raise just by consistently adding to that account and not paying taxes on the gains. And keep in mind, with 401ks and regular traditional IRAs, you get to deduct that $2,000 off of your net income on your tax return. So it adds up pretty quickly. So I think his talk on IRAs and tax-sheltered compounding, I think that's great. He's got one example of somebody who started early. They were 20 years old, and for 5 years, they added $2,000 a year, and then they forgot about it. You know, they ignored it for another 30 years. And at the very end, it shows a huge amount of money in their IRA. So that's good discussion from Dave Ramsey, and I know spreadsheets are made for that. What I did was probably a lot better done on a spreadsheet, but it's good discussion. And I think 8% per year return in a S&P 500 index fund is realistic. Now, when you look up S&P 500 index mutual funds, the name of the game is to find one with the lowest amount of administrative fees. I understand Vanguard is okay. There's a company called TIAA-CREF, TIAA-CREF. And also USAA, which is a good financial company in general. By the way, there are possibilities out there. If you open a mutual fund account, there are all sorts of mutual funds out there. There are politically correct funds, which a lot of them are becoming anyway, where they only invest in politically correct stuff. There are mutual funds that will only invest in biblically based investments. There are some mutual funds out there. There's one that comes in mind called the Vice Fund that they invest in politically incorrect stuff like oil and gas and chemical and the dreaded Monsanto, Rick's Cabaret. I don't know if that's still publicly traded, but the Vice Fund would probably invest in that. Stuff like that, you know, tobacco, whatever. There are all sorts of mutual funds out there, and it's probably easiest just to invest in an S&P 500 index fund. Now, here's another thing as far as savings. He's talking about only cash in a money market or in a mutual fund. Here's a problem. Some people have a hard time sending money away knowing that it will wind up in the stock market. I'm not going to name any names, but there are other ways that you can accumulate net wealth. There are other places you can put your savings. If you have a spouse who just does not want to mail off money to the stock market, I would recommend that you look into real estate. And I spent a whole chapter in my book, Dirt Cheap Valuable Survival Retreat. It's a good idea not only to look at some vacant land way out in the country for a possible survival retreat. Yes, that's important. But also keep in mind that it's possible for you to do this. If you buy that property on the outskirts of a growing town, the town will keep growing. And at some point, your property won't be way out in the country anymore. It will be surrounded by suburbs and a mall. You can sell that property at a huge profit, and then you can start all over again. Look for another survival retreat property way outside of this growing metropolis, and buy that and wait for suburbia to surround it again. And anyway, buying property is something that you can use to increase your savings. And it's something that you can say, there's also something else going on, you know, the survival retreat aspect of it. And if you have a spouse who hesitates investing in the stock market, or if that describes you, then there's something to be said about buying a piece of property and going out there and just walking around and just saying, hey, I own this land here. If there's a creek ideally going through it, I own that too. I own that tree. I can do stuff here. And I'm the only boss aside from local rules and county ordinances and so forth. But the idea of real estate for savings is something that Dave Ramsey ignores. And I don't think that's a good thing. I think it's something that's realistic for some couples. All right, here's another thing as far as savings. He doesn't even touch on precious metals. And we survivalists consider that a big deal. It could be that some of us put too much of our savings into precious metals. But I think at the very least, it's a good idea for everybody to have something. And if you have, personally, I think when it comes to gold, 1 ounce Krugerrand coins are the way to go because they're relatively liquid at tax time or whenever. If you feel that you really need some money fast and you don't want to get a cash advance from your credit card, you can always bring a Krugerrand or two into your local coin shop. And literally, it's just like, hey, what's the price of gold today? Well, here's the price. If you sell me that Krugerrand, I'll take off whatever percent, you know, and then you have just cash handed over to you. So it's almost like a savings account on its own without any paperwork. But Krugerrands and junk silver are a good idea to have. Junk silver is smaller denomination coins up through 1964 and before. Because for that time frame, dimes, for example, were made from 90% silver and 10% everything else. In case there is a, God forbid, societal collapse, that's what everybody's going to be using as currency, is junk silver. So it's a good idea to buy rolls of, I think, dimes, but quarters are available too, of junk silver. And I think it's worth it to buy those really sturdy plastic coin holders. So that's another area where I would disagree with Dave Ramsey as far as savings, is don't only think about mailing off money to a mutual fund that invests in the stock market. Real estate is okay, and precious metals as well. Okay, another disagreement I have, and I'm kind of tempered on this. He's talking about cash being a good thing to use when you buy stuff. And yes, there is something to be said, and absolutely, there's a discussion on the psychology involved, that if you walk into a store knowing that you need to buy something and you have in your hand or your pocket a bunch of cash, you will be less likely to want to part with that cash. And meanwhile, the salesman you're dealing with, they might drool, but they will also be more inclined to give you better deals knowing that you're about to hand over cash. You know, cash doesn't bounce. It might be worthless if there's a worldwide hyperinflation, but that's different. I'm talking about today. If you have something big to buy, like a refrigerator, and you walk into an appliance store with cash, you will probably get a whole lot better deal. And of course, the psychology involved, you will be less likely to spend all of that cash. You know, refrigerators come with all sorts of different things right now. Some of them have their own internet connection. Some of them have, it's like a TV screen on the front. And some of them have just basic left and right or top and bottom. Some of them you can get ice water from, that kind of thing. All sorts of different options for a refrigerator. And if you're walking into an appliance store with cash, chances are pretty good you'll probably buy one with fewer options because you want to hold on to that cash. And the person you're dealing with will see that, and the salesman will probably give you your better deals. Okay, in one of these episodes of the Financial Peace University, Dave Ramsey talks about, okay, gee, if you're going to have to replace that refrigerator, for example, you know, every 5 to 7 years or whatever, and it costs $2,000. Divide that per month and put that $5 or $10 worth of cash into some envelope and have the envelope write the word refrigerator on it. So you're kind of paying for a new refrigerator while you're waiting for the old one to die. Now, some people are excited and they think that's a great idea. I just think, yeah, I know it's debt and credit card debt is bad, but I'd rather not bother with that. And besides, that's a lot of envelopes. I mean, remember, we're talking about refrigerators, but also we're talking about dishwashers, washers and dryers, you know, the air conditioning, all of this stuff. That's a lot of envelopes that you're putting a lot of $10 and $20 bills into. And I'd rather just, you know, forget it. Just whip out the credit card and pay for a new refrigerator and then just pay the credit card down. You kind of have to be watchful of all your credit card debts, but it's kind of a hassle, I think. Between that and the $1,000 that he wants you to save up in cash, that's a lot of cash hanging around your house, which I'm not too crazy about. But anyway, I'd rather just go with a credit card, buy a new refrigerator. Yes, I probably would be more inclined to buy a few more options. And, you know, he's right in that respect. Paying cash, you'll spend less and get a better deal. There's also a home warranty service that might be the same idea. I don't know what their administrative charge would be, but the idea of a home warranty service is that you pay a certain amount of money every month. And for those months in the future that your air conditioning goes out and needs replacing or whatever, then the home warranty company, theoretically, will pay to replace it. I haven't dealt with a home warranty company, but I know that there is that option. All right, let me talk a little bit about the snowball effect on paying off your credit card debts. And this is good. This is where Dave Ramsey really shines in his Financial Peace University. First off, in that episode, they'll have a few testimonies from people who got way in over their heads with debt. And you can just feel just the fear and the despair of these people. And you think, oh, wow, I hope I never get into that situation. There was one biker guy, a couple of tattoos here and there. It looks pretty rugged, you know, wearing the black leather vest. And he kept getting increases in the balance allowed on his credit card. And he would just max it out all the time. And as the years went on, he found out all of his credit cards were maxed. He had nothing he could spend if there was an emergency. And sure enough, an emergency came around. He was out on a road trip with his motorcycle, and part of his motorcycle broke down and he needed it fixed. And the poor guy was like tears coming out of his eyes. And you could just feel this guy was really bummed and desperate and feeling awful that he had screwed up his finances so much. So anyway, the testimonies on that episode are fantastic. And you kind of feel this is serious. You know, getting in over your head with debt is horrible. Anyway, here's the snowball method. Take all your credit cards and list them and list what you owe and list the interest rate that they charge you. Let's say you have 6 different credit cards. The lowest balance is, say, $120. The highest balance is $6,000, and you've got everything in between. Okay. The mathematician would say, all right, which one of those credit cards has the highest interest rate? And that's the one I'll pay off first. But Dave Ramsey says, no, this is a psychological thing. This is a behavioral thing. So just look at the lowest credit card, the credit card that you owe the lowest amount of money to. Pay that off first. And that way, you've got yourself an accomplishment. You're one step closer to being debt-free. So that $120 credit card, pay that off first, and then consider yourself that much more responsible. You know, and like I said, it's a behavioral, it's a psychological thing. So start off with the smallest one, and this is called a snowball, and then attack the next smallest one. And then after that, the next, at some point you're going to be paying off this credit card with a huge balance. But what will keep you going is this psychological aspect, this knowledge that, hey, I can do this, because it's hard, you know, month after month after month after month, paying off the same damn credit card. But if you have this snowball effect, if you have this behavioral reinforcement, you know that you can do it, it'll keep you doing it. So I think that's really good. It's called the debt snowball, and it works. Okay, I wanted to talk about cars, and I've considered seriously having its own episode of the Survival in Motion podcast just on cars. Dave Ramsey recommends buying a beater car, and he keeps using the term beater car. And coincidentally, when we began this course, the instructor's son, who is college age, I think he just graduated, and he's not a car mechanic, but he could be, you know, he's one of those. And coincidentally, at the beginning of this course, he bought a 20-year-old used Honda Civic, and a number of things were going wrong with it. But, you know, for a mechanic, sometimes that's fun. You know, that's a feature of your car. Oh, there's something else to go wrong and something else that I can fix. So this guy was every week telling us more things that he found not working on that car and the steps he had been taking at repairing that. You know, one week it was, oh, you know, that window motor, I got a replacement part coming. And he showed us the door panel for one of the doors was off and he was working on something else. Anyway, I don't think that's realistic for everybody. But if you drive, say, 10, 20, maybe 30,000 miles a year, I think it's okay to buy a sedan for your family that is maybe 5 to 10 years old. You can get some 5 to 10 year old sedans that have just been detailed and they look new and they feel new. So I think that's okay. I don't think a beater car is a good idea. I mean, unless you just barely drive at all. It's something that's just too important. By the way, Hondas and Toyotas are usually at the top of the list as far as being able to drive them a long, long way and not having any big time repairs. But I'd say 5 to 10 year old car for a sedan, you know, family of four is good. If you drive 50,000 miles a year like I do, I have no problem going into a car dealer and buying a brand new commuter car. Because like I said, I drive 50,000 miles a year and I will get rid of my car one way or the other after about 250 to 300,000 miles. So the savings that I could make by buying a slightly used car just doesn't add up. I mean, by the end of your car's life, it's almost impossible to put the numbers to paper. But all of us know kind of what we've put into the car as far as paying for the car, insuring the car, registering the car, repairs for the car, how much gas you put in the car versus how many miles you have driven. And I get a lot of value for my little commuter cars lately they've been hybrid, and yeah, I just get such great value. I don't care about buying a used car. I have no financial guilt at all in buying a brand new car. But that's if you drive 50,000 miles a year or more. All right, when it comes to getting a new car, if you are so inclined, if you drive a lot, there are three considerations for that transaction. What you're going to do with your old car. And in my case, I advertise it on Craigslist. I show a few photos. I admit everything that's wrong with the car, which is not much, but I say this has X number of miles. I suspect there's a problem over there. There was a fender bender a few years ago, whatever. So it's a quick sale and no one's going to come back and hassle me about it later. Anyway, number one, in car transactions, when you buy a new car, what are you going to do with your old car? You can always donate it. Maybe that's worth it tax-wise. It might not be. Or if you're active in your church, like me, you know a lot of really good families. Every once in a while, somebody needs a used car donated to them. I have no problem doing that. All right, so I was going down my list of things to look into with a new car purchase. What to do with your old car? Obviously, the price of the new car. And the last couple of new cars I've bought, I've done through the Costco car buying service. And what they do, it's not just a throwaway line with the car salesman. And they say, oh, okay, you're in Costco. I'll take off $200 on the price. No, no. What it is you log into the Costco website. You give your Costco membership number, and then you press on the tab that you want help with their car buying service. You're interested in this make, this model, this trim level, and this color. And press enter, and they say, okay, here's the salesman for that brand of car at that dealership near you. Contact that person only. And then you will contact that person, and they will say, oh, Costco told me you would be contacting me. You wanted this make, this model, this trim package, and this color. We have one over here. And they showed me both times. Here's what our dealership paid to bring this car in. In other words, the invoice. Now, it could always be faked. I could always be lied to. Yes, I know. But it's a great feeling when you want to buy a new car to see the MSRP on the window and then realize you're paying whatever, $2,000, $3,000 below that. So that's another consideration. And that would be a recommendation I have is BJ's might have all this too, but Costco, definitely I've used them with buying a brand new car, and I save several thousand dollars off the MSRP the two times I've done it. All right, three considerations for buying a new car: what you're going to do with the old car, the price of the new car, and financing the new car or paying cash. Dave Ramsey would recommend just saving up a whole bunch of cash and paying for it. You know, if you buy a used car, I don't know, $10,000 or less, I guess that's okay, but I buy new cars, like I said, because I drive them to death. So financing the car, that interest rate I pay is important. So credit unions are a great place to get car financing. And just about everybody can join a credit union. You don't have to be working in a certain place. If you look around your location, there are probably credit unions in your neighborhood that will allow you to join. And like I said, the Costco car buying plan is great. Okay, like I said, I drive 50,000 miles a year. The last car I had almost 300,000 miles on it. I sold it on Craigslist and I listed everything that was wrong or even suspected to be wrong with the car. So there was no way the buyer could come back and say, hey, I didn't know this. I also gave the buyer a compression report from the engine. And let me tell you about that. That's the whole subject all its own. Your engine has pistons that slide up and down inside of a cylinder, and there's an explosion that sends the piston back down, and that's what gets the crankshaft turning, and that's what moves your car. As the years go by, naturally your engine compression will not be what it used to be. But if you keep up to date on replacing your car's oil and the oil filter, then even after 300,000 miles, you can have an engine with really good compression. And in my case, it was almost new. Of course, it had worn out a little bit, but My car had almost 300,000 miles on it, and I had a compression check done, and I handed that report to the buyer, and I said, see, this shows that that engine is still not as worn out as you might expect. How did I do that? If there's one thing that I spend a lot on, it's fully synthetic oil with my car and high-end oil filters. And the way I do it is, you know, when I'm grocery shopping at Walmart, I might say, oh, I'll just mosey on over to the auto section and I'll pick up a quart of Mobil 1 fully synthetic oil. And I'll just put that in the trunk of my car. And then one of these times I'll buy a really good oil filter, whether it's the Mobil 1 filter or a Fram, you know, top of the line, whatever. I'll buy that and I'll also put that in the trunk of the car. And I keep my eyes open. I ask around, where's a good place that will do lube oil filter for the least amount of money? And I found one place right nearby one of the courthouses I go to every once in a while. They charge $15 and you have to provide your own oil and your own oil filter. And in half an hour, it's done. And I give them $15 and I drive off. It's great. There's one place, a different location that will charge $25 for the same thing, except they want to rotate the tires too. That's all right. That's okay. So as I replace the oil, every, say, three or four fill-ups I get, I open the hood, check the oil level, and then I also look at the oil. Does it still look clean, or is it starting to look a little old? And I'd say I wind up changing the oil and the oil filter every 15, 20,000 miles, which might be a bit much. It's recommended every 5,000 to 7,000 miles, whatever. But I think so long as the oil is looking good and clear and it's not smoky or dirty, I think 15,000 to 20,000 miles is okay. But I make sure it's fully synthetic oil and it's a good oil filter. And that way, the engine does not wear out as much. I've seen some engines through the years that the owner hasn't bothered changing the oil and it doesn't have that protection and the compression is just not what it should be. All right, I call it lube oil filter. Let me explain the lube part. In all cars, metal will rub against metal. For example, when you turn the wheel, those are the steering bars that kind of rub up against each other, or they hinge on each other. The car maker will put at that location, I hate using this term, a nipple right there. And when you bring your car in for a lube oil filter, the lube part of it is when they raise your car and they hook in, it's like a hose or it's like a squirt gun filled with sludgy oil. They'll hook it in to that nipple and they'll squeeze in some lubrication there so that whenever the metal is rubbing against metal or turning on metal, it'll age a lot better with that lubrication in there. So that's how I do it. I keep my cars in good shape, mostly because of fully synthetic oil, the oil filter, and I make sure it's done well. And by the way, this is not on my notes, but I think it's horrible. There was one time a couple years ago, they said, we'll change your car's oil and you can just stay seated in the car. Big mistake, because every 5 minutes or so, they'd come back and say, hey, look, we found the windshield washer fluid. We found that yours is kind of a mess. It's all kind of watered down. And look at all this bug guts on your windshield. Oh, you need this $20 bottle of, oh yeah, baby. You need this stuff. I'd say, no, thank you. And then another 5 minutes comes by and they say, oh, you know, we just noticed this too. Oh, this is awful. Oh, you won't get very far with this. You've got to replace this. I say, no, no, thank you. So I would caution you against going into one of those, sit in your car while your oil is changed. I mean, I'll listen to a mechanic who says, hey, you know, I think this part over here might need some attention after a while, or you can replace it right now or whatever. I'm okay with that, but just not on and on and on and on. So I'd stay away from those centers that will change your oil while you're sitting there in the driver's seat. So one last thing I wanted to mention as far as buying a car, one last thing is when you buy a car, there's that price that you agree to pay for it. There's the financing and they always tell you, oh, you have to go by the finance guy and sign some papers then we'll give you the key fob or the key or whatever to your car and you can drive it away. Okay. That is always somebody trying to sell you another six or eight things. So what I've gotten in the habit of doing now is I work out a deal, usually at invoice with the car salesman, and then I've got financing in place. Okay. And then he says, okay, you have to talk to the finance guy and then you're done. And then I tell him, okay, but I'm not going to buy anything else. Extended warranty for somebody like me, I blow right through the maximum mile. So extended warranty is pretty worthless with me. The only thing I'll take seriously is maybe a low jack or something that can find my car if it gets stolen, that kind of thing. But it's amazing all the different things they try to sell you, like clear coat will help your paint. I don't think so. No. So I just say no thanks. There's some kind of sticker that they'll stick inside your door that will make it easier, supposedly, if your car gets stolen. I don't think so. Scotch guard on your upholstery. No, no thanks. A lot of this stuff, if you're buying a good car to begin with, I don't think you need any of that. Anyway, that's on my list. I wanted to mention that as well. But Dave Ramsey talks about getting a beater car, which I don't think is always a good idea. Anyway, I think our time here is done. I hope you found today's episode of the Survival in Motion podcast informative and entertaining. Hopefully you got some insight on the Dave Ramsey Financial Peace University seminar, which I would recommend with the reservations I've discussed. Anyway, I hear the music. That means our time is up. Thanks for joining me. God bless.